They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WEBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. On the Commons today, we have John Cowherd. Many of you know John. He's been on the show many times. He also has a blog, and we'll be talking a little bit about that. John, thank you so much for coming on today. You have a very important message for our listeners today. So why don't we get started here? Thank you for coming.
Sure, Sue. Thanks for having me back on the show. I always enjoy our conversations on the Commons. Lately, I've been becoming very interested in the topic of these HOA disclosure packets that purchasers receive when they first, when they're under contract to buy an HOA property and they're waiting to go to closing. And I'm not simply as interested in what's in the packets and whether that's kind of what the rules are about the packets and about the right to cancel the deal. I've become very interested in how this fits in the big picture of HOAs and condominiums. What does it mean to be in an HOA and have these restrictive covenants that burden your property and by extension burdening your life? Like what the Supreme Court of Virginia has described the relationship between an HOA and the owner as a contractual one. What does this mean? What does it mean to have a contract like that formed or to be added in as a substitute party to that contract? How are we to understand this, and what does this mean for the rights of owners, both when they purchase the property, when they're living in it and living underneath the board, and then when they go to sell? Because that's really, in my mind, that's really where the rubber meets the road as far as the property rights of homeowners and community associations these days.
John, you said a couple of things here that really got me thinking and I thought were brilliant. It's burdening your life, and I want to come back and talk a little bit about that, but also you talk about substituting the party to the contract. I know what you mean by both of those, but let's talk about that, because how do people know what's going on when they go in and buy a house? How do you burden your life with that?
Well, that's a great question. You know, the restrictive covenants are obligations that kind of come along with a deed to a house that were added on to the title probably many years before the purchaser ever even did an initial tour or walkthrough of the property. They are placed on the property's title by a recording of a declaration or some other real estate land document that lists all the different things that are the features of an HOA: a board of directors, rights of membership, voting rights, basics of what you can or cannot do on the property, the dues. I'm not going to go through and list everything that's in a declaration, but It includes restrictive covenants that tell owners things like you can't do an addition without the approval of the Architectural Review Committee, or it says things like you can't set up a statue on your front lawn that meet, you know, that you feel, you know, expresses your artistic feelings or something like that. Other and a variety of other restrictions that many owners, once they go to live in the property, discover that are really very irksome to them. And so how do these rules, why are we even talking about these rules? This is a contract that was entered into between the developer and the original owners. And how is it that these obligations pass on to new purchasers when they weren't a party to the original deal? And what many people don't realize is that in Virginia, like elsewhere, this whole concept of restrictive covenants that run with the land, that bind subsequent purchasers and people who inherit the property on into the future, is not something that was created by a secret committee of community association lawyers who, you know, are meeting at a national convention or something like that.
They're buried in somebody's basement, right, hiding right. down there, right?
No, this is restrictive covenants are things that go back to the founding of our republic, and even before that in the British common law.
Yeah.
So they are something that are very ancient, but that ancient tradition is very skeptical and does not like these restrictive covenants, because restrictive covenants they have a tendency to bind the future in a way that is troublesome. Like, for example, if you work for a pest control company, and you, this is not a real estate analogy, but if you work for a pest control company, and when you go up to work for the pest control company, you sign a contract that says you will not compete against the pest control company for X number of years and within X number of miles from a certain place regarding pest control activities, because the employer doesn't want you to get to know all the customers and know where they are and who they are and know which ones pay well, right, and which ones don't pay well, and then leave the company and take all the business from him. But you know, if someone goes to work for the pest control company for several years and then for whatever reason wants to leave and find gainful employment, if you can't be a pest control person, then that's really a shame, because you have someone with legitimate work skills who knows how to do it and has familiarity with the area and has people who want to hire him, but he can't do the work because he signed this contract a long time ago. So the Supreme Court of Virginia, like other courts across the country, have developed rules where they like to go in and they like to invalidate these covenants not to compete because they're too broad. They're overbroad and they are too restrictive on people's future employment. And so restrictive covenants in the real estate context are similar in the sense that if you have restrictive covenants that, let's say, impair your ability to operate a home-based business at your house, then that means that your house can only really be used for living in, for residential purposes, and perhaps whatever home-based activity you can do just on your computer or hiding in your basement. Many people, when they're looking to buy a house, they would like, it would be very great, it would be wonderful if someone could start a home-based business if they want to start a business, to base it out of their home, because that would mean they wouldn't have to go and get other real estate in order to start the business. So these restrictive covenants about home-based businesses in many ways are an impediment to people's economic opportunities and their ability to provide for themselves and for their families. That's just one example. There are many restrictive covenants that are out there, and we could probably spend a whole show listing them. We already have a few, but historically, the courts have been very skeptical of these restrictive covenants because, according to this old school way of looking at things, the restrictive covenants damage the property values because you can't use the property in different ways, and it makes it possible for some person who has a right to enforce that, who might have a right to enforce that covenant, to go into court and to kind of be somewhat capricious in the way that they try to enforce it. So the courts for many, many hundreds of years have had a practice of refusing to enforce these covenants for this very reason. They don't like, you know, property. Why should people in the present have the power to burden the use of property in the future when they may not even be in that future?
John, I want to stop right there, because when you talk to people about this particular covenant, about no home-based businesses, they'll always say, do you want a slaughterhouse next door or a gas station down the street? And that seems to be the only business. But we're looking at a situation now where you have computers, where you have all kinds of electronic stuff, where it's perfectly feasible. You're not going to impact the neighborhood at all. And you can work at home, stay off the roads, save gas, you know, not contribute to clogging the traffic anymore, because here you know that it's going to take you forever to get anywhere. And yet we still cling to this absolutely idiotic thing. And CAI's response is, well, would you like someone to build a slaughterhouse next door to you? Is that likely to happen? I mean, come on.
Well, I mean,
seriously.
You also have zoning regulations, which But you don't have zoning regulations everywhere. You know, you might have...
Houston's the only place I know of that doesn't have zoning regulations. Are there more?
I mean, you might want to set up an HOA in a more rural area where perhaps there aren't strict restrictions against home-based businesses. I know if you travel out in many rural counties in Virginia and Maryland, you'll see a lot of people... It's obvious just by driving down the road that they are using a property both for residential and for commercial purposes.
Isn't that great?
They've got an auto mechanic. They got a tow truck and maybe some auto mechanics stuff there. And they're also living there, and kids are playing in the yard. I don't want a cement factory to open up next door to my house, but I also, you know, I would not like to see my neighbors who perhaps are running a bathroom remodeling business out of their house to have that business shut down because somebody decided they should no longer be able to park work-related trucks or vans in the driveway. I think it's troublesome to me that we wouldn't be able to climb out of the recession because we're too worried about whether all the driveways look the same in the community. Like what's more important?
We've had stories about authors who have not been allowed to write from home because they're running a business out of their homes, and they've been forced to go out and get rent office space and go like normal people, quote unquote, and work there. People who have websites, aha, you're running a business out of your home. You've got a website right there. We've seen it. We can see it. and you're in violation, and we're going to fine you, and we're going to foreclose to collect the fine. I mean, it's got to the point where it's absolutely ridiculous. Cement truck, how many cement trucks are going to move in next? I mean, yeah, if you're going to move out into the rural countryside, then, you know, you talk about that.
Right.
And when you drive out there, you see small farms where they have farm stands, and you can go and buy fresh fruit, not stuff
right.
that was picked a month ago and shipped up here. You know, to me, that's just a joy to
right.
see.
And so I think that the kind of the traditional or classic way of looking at restrictive covenants is that they should only be allowed for if they meet certain strict requirements, and then they're for a proper purpose.
If they're going to impact the neighborhood, if they're going to impact the people next door, then yes. I mean, you can't assert your right while impinging on somebody else's right. But if it's not going to impact you, if you're sitting at home writing a book, is that going to hurt your neighbors? I mean, there has to
right,
be some
right,
common
right,
sense.
Right, right, right. And certainly common sense is a big part of it. And as I was thinking about, I became interested in this because of the question of how is it that people find themselves parties to a contract that they never actually negotiated. And with these things, they may not actually understand the terms of the contract when they buy their house. You know, we know from different things you read on the internet or people, I mean, I'm sure just as I have, people have contacted you and from the conversation, you can tell that they never understood that they were entering into this HOA contract, in quotation marks, when they bought the place. How is this longstanding device of restrictive covenants attaching to these people's properties when they don't understand what they're getting themselves into, and the law itself has a traditional skepticism towards these restrictive covenants. I've become very interested in this question because, you know, as a litigation attorney, you want to be able to explain the nuances of the contract to the judge or to the jury and to your client, to the opposing lawyer, because what the contract means and how it might or might not be enforced in court is a very important issue to deciding any kind of dispute, whether it's an HOA matter or something else. And if you don't understand how that contract, how those covenants actually continue to encumber the property, you know, then it's hard to explain it. And I think in our property law, there is a term called running with the land. I'm sure you've heard
mm-hmm.
this before.
Oh, yeah. Covenant has to run with the land.
Covenants, in order for HOA covenants to be enforceable, one of the things is they have to, quote,
run
unquote,
with the land.
Run with the land, yeah. Which means that they are not simply terms to an agreement between the original parties, but meet the requirements to make future purchasers members of the HOA and subject to those restrictive covenants. So the question becomes, how do these HOA governing documents that are recorded in the land records, how do they overcome this legal hurdle to being enforceable against so many people across this state and nationwide? And these are the kind of things I've been focusing on my blog recently.
You know, I think those are all excellent, excellent points. And we're talking a lot about, and we started off with disclosure packets.
Right.
And in Virginia, it's been the law for 25 years that any purchaser who puts in a contract on a property is given a packet. that right. include certain
you
things.
Hopefully are.
They are, when this whole thing started, it was the purchaser could request a package. The association could charge the actual cost of producing that package up to $100 or up to $25. Overnight, when they changed the law and they said, "Oops, it's you can charge up to 50. It still has to be the actual cost, up to $50 for the package." Every single HOA in Virginia could prove without a shadow of a doubt that it cost them $50 overnight. The cost went from 25, which they could prove it cost them 25, to, oh, well, now it costs $50 overnight. Coincidentally, it's the day the new law took effect. So people were getting these packages, sometimes at the settlement table, because the settlement attorney had to make sure that you had signed off on it. Oops, you haven't given it to them. Well, here it is. Sign off. But the law also says that you have 72 hours to rescind the contract should you find anything in there that is unacceptable. Right?
It's actually, the law right now has changed a little bit from that. In Virginia, for resales, I'm not talking about original offerings, but for resales, the rule is that the contract has to in the real estate contract that is signed between the seller and the buyer, a month before closing, the seller has to disclose whether or not the property is in an HOA or in a condominium association. And then the contract also gives these contract language is just drawn straight from the sections of the Virginia Code. It's all statutory. It's just been put into the contracts. So the seller has to disclose, and the buyer gets what's called the HOA contingency. And what that means is that at some point during the deal, during pre-closing, the seller will send the buyer the HOA disclosure packet documents. That's supposed to be this big phone book sized packet of things that contain the articles of incorporation, the bylaws, the declarations, the restrictive covenants, the rules, the regulations, the reserve study. I'm not going to list all of them because it's, but it's a big binder's worth of legal and financial mumbo jumbo that make up the DNA, as it were, of the association or the rules of the road and basic things like how much money does the association have in their bank accounts? Can they afford to do a major road replacement that's necessary? It should answer questions like that. So they're supposed to send out this packet or to tell the buyer that there is no packet that is going to be produced. So at some point during...
So that's the law now? You don't have to produce the packet?
Well, if instead of producing a packet, the seller produces a single sheet of paper that says, "Dear buyer, the packet is unavailable, XOXO Board of Directors," From the rights of the buyer's perspective, it really doesn't matter. Whatever happens, whether the HOA provides a complete and comprehensive packet of documents that contains each and every document that it is required to produce under the statute, under the contract, or whether they don't, the right of the buyer is the same, which is the buyer can void the real estate contract and get their security deposit, their earnest money deposit back, simply by sending a valid notice within 3 days. So only 3 days to figure all this stuff out. So there is this very powerful right of cancellation that exists under the law and in these contracts, but in practicality, this right of cancellation is very rarely exercised because you don't. I mean, if you are in a very busy time of your life, and someone emails you or delivers to you a phone book sized packet of legal and financial mumbo jumbo and says that you get 3 days to accept this or reject it and get out of the deal, most attorneys would struggle to make sense out of it all in 3 days, and same with CPAs. These are things that are designed not to be a user manual for the homeowners, but to be something that would be a judge would read it, and after being briefed by the parties, would rule that it's enforceable. It's designed to be, or would rule that it's not enforceable. It's a legal document, and it's not designed to be user friendly. So what we have in the Commonwealth is a situation where you have this right to get the disclosure packets, and in many cases the disclosure packets are defective. They don't contain everything that they're supposed to contain.
Or they're out of date.
Right. And so, and then the homeowner, I mean, think about the homeowner situation. You get the packet at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday. And then, you know, you go home and then your baby's crying and you got to give the baby a bath and you need to talk with your spouse about how to come up with the financing to purchase the house, and you know your neighbor's knocking on the door because they lost their dog, and then the next day you decide to spend a little bit of time going through the disclosure packet, and let's even say that you read through the whole thing. By that time, you may be in the morning of the third day before you realize, hey, I don't understand what this means. I don't understand what this would mean if I would have to go to court on it. Who is this designed to restrict? What do all these terms mean? So there on the, you know, towards the end of the disclosure period, the cancellation period, someone might kind of throw up their hands and realize they can't figure it out. But by that time, it's probably too late to go and to find an attorney or a CPA or somebody who has the professional training and experience. It could even be somebody else, but find somebody who can explain it to them that's not working for the seller or working for the HOA or somebody who has kind of a conflict of interest, so to speak. So it's one settlement attorney that I spoke with about this told me that he thought that this 3-day cancellation period is just a joke.
You know, I totally agree with you, but here's something else I'm going to throw into the mix. And that is that at that point, it is too late. Because, and I've said this a million times on this show, buying a house is an emotional purchase.
Right.
You're not kicking the tires. You're not looking under the hood. You're falling in love with the view from the window, the smell of the brownies in the baking in the oven, the nice cozy nook, reading
right.
nook that you can just imagine yourself sitting there and reading. I think that you have to let them know ahead of time what they're getting into in general about HOAs. The problem is, because of the HOA mandates, in most places, including in Fairfax County, Virginia, there are no options. In excess of 90% of all housing in Fairfax County is in an HOA.
Right.
So you have no option. And you either buy a house and you're subjected to this nonsense or not. But you can't say, fall in love with this house. Oh, by the way, you're going to have to do this, that, and the other.
Right. Right. And I think that the situation is just begging for some reforms. But I think in order to understand the reforms, you have to also understand kind of the how the sausage was made to begin with, which is this, as you mentioned before, the problems that existed before these rules were enacted to provide for these disclosure packets, where buyers were not really having any idea of what they were getting themselves into, and many of them were not taking the time to actually demand these things as a part of the contract. And you had association lawyer types who were frustrated that sometimes they weren't getting everything they wanted when they went to court because the judges were reticent against enforcing them. And they wanted these things to be enforced more regularly and routinely and consistently. And then on the other side of the equation, you have consumers who want, if these things are going to be enforced against them, they want to know what they are before they buy. Otherwise, it's not really a contract if you don't really know what you're getting yourself into. So there is this. A lot of impulses went into creating the kind of structure that we have now, but ultimately, what it's about is it's about tweaking the rules that existed beforehand, which were that judges were hesitant and skeptical against enforcing restrictive covenants because there had to be privity of contract between the person trying to enforce them and the person being burdened by them. So these rules that exist about the disclosure packets aren't a whole cloth new addition to the law, a new creation that comes to us through various lobbying interests, but they are a widening of this exception against the general rule of skepticism towards restrictive covenants. And so, there's lots of things that need to be done, but in many ways, the system that existed beforehand was not terrible. It just was kind of very confusing for everyone. Does that make sense?
It does, and I'm sitting here listening to you and wondering to myself, would it help if we put this in plain language as opposed to legalese? Because even lawyers don't understand what they're signing. HOAs typically ignore, and they act outside the scope of their authority. They enforce things they don't have the authority to enforce, and they keep going with that. But I've had attorneys tell me, I went through everything is spelled out except what they're going after me for. I mean,
right.
They'll talk about this, that, and the other, and everything is really... I'm an attorney, and I don't get it. I didn't see this coming. So they've created these loopholes within all this legal mumbo-jumbo. The loopholes are big enough that you can throw anything through them.
Right. I mean, I think that one comparison that can be made is with mortgage finance. I mean, our country got into a big mess because these subprime loans were being sold and being used to finance purchases of homes many years ago, and the borrowers had no idea of what the terms meant. They didn't understand what an interest-only loan was or what an adjustable-rate loan was,
right,
or any of these sexy loan products that we know now are... they're like playing with fire as far as the housing market is concerned. And in fact, it's scaringly enough, the government is bringing these loan products back, and they're reintroducing them into residential real estate in a hope of jumpstarting the real estate economy again. But these loans were provided to the borrowers by the brokers when the borrowers had no idea of what what they meant or what the terms meant. And always the borrowers were told by the brokers that, oh, well, you know, the market is great. If you don't like some of the features of this loan, you can just refinance it to a 30-year fixed in 5 years.
Sometimes, John, the reason they used a lot of this alternate financing was to qualify the homeowner because they couldn't qualify for a fixed rate. And so my big contention is if you can't qualify, if you can't afford it, if you can't qualify for it, why put you in a bind? I mean, that arm is going to come due at some point.
Right, and it did come due, and we all have been suffering through everything that has happened since 2007 and 2008, in which, in many ways, the economy has not as yet to recover, especially in the job sector. And I think in the HOA context, it's an interesting comparison because the federal government did a lot or tried to do a lot to try to make home loans more transparent to borrowers. They created these forms that mortgage lenders are required to give to borrowers that are a couple pages, and they're trying to boil down what the essential terms are of the loans so that at least someone can say that they complied with federal regulations in providing and making a transparent explanation of the loan product that was offered. In the HOA context, the disclosure system is much, I don't know if primitive is the word, but it's much less effective than what people find when they're borrowing their mortgages. But it's just as important to people's property rights and to their ability to keep their home and to live in it and to be able to use it the way that they ought to be able to use it, because these covenants aren't simply something you have to pay, but you have to follow these rules. Otherwise, you're going to end up with either a lien or in litigation.
What about where the HOA sort of acts ultra vires, outside the scope of their authority? Because that's what I hear a lot of. I think people are savvier now than they used to be. The stories are all over the place. So people have a certain expectation. But then they come and they say, can the association do this? There's nothing in my governing documents that says anything at all about this.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, and I have to mention this.
I love attorneys. I love having attorneys in here because they always come in with a whole stack of paperwork, and they can reach in there and find what they need, and that's what John's doing now.
Someone had an idea, which was that what if the state government created a form that would be like a warning label that would go on the front of these packets, and would the government would create this form, as this regulatory agency would create a form, and they'd slap it on as a cover page onto these packets, and that would, it'd be like, kind of what the FDA requires on food. It would be something where people could just read the big print and then at least know whether they want to read the small print or not. And so the General Assembly adopted one of these statutes, and they told the Common Interest Community Board down in Richmond that they were to create this form, and that this form would go into every packet in the whole state moving forward. Most of the form is fine. It doesn't really tell much. I mean, it doesn't... It
never was intended to tell anything,
well,
is it?
Whatever it was intended to tell, I don't know. But it has this very, very curious sentence in here, which is... And this is the only underlined portion of this form, this official Virginia...
This is underlined on the website. You sent it to me.
It's it says the purchaser is bound by all decisions of the association and the board of directors and the provisions of the governing documents. So let's parse this for a second. What they're saying here is that if you go to closing, if you don't exercise your right of cancellation, you are bound by all the decisions of the board of directors.
Don't worry about it. They're going to be acting right in your best interest, right, John?
And this is on a form at the top says the Commonwealth of Virginia Department of Professional and Occupational Regulation.
And this is, for those of you listening who are not in Virginia, this is the same agency that has the ombudsman that you all think is such a great idea and you want to have in your states. Listen to this. It's a mess.
So this is what the regulatory state is telling purchasers and is telling people who might end up in your association. We could talk about this and say, well, we don't like this. We don't like this. It's saying that the board has all this authority. But what I don't like about it is that they are saying the exact opposite. They're saying the opposite of what the Supreme Court of Virginia has repeatedly held and what other courts in the state have repeatedly held, which is that the board of an HOA only has the authority that they are given in the governing documents,
right,
and that they are delegated. They just don't have a carte blanche to kind of do what they want to do. This suggests that they do, but the board has to follow the Declaration of Covenants, the bylaws, the articles of incorporation, the rules and regulations, and the provisions of the Non-Stock Corporation Act and the Property Owners Association Act and all the other law that applies to this. So this is not John Cowherd's interpretation of some cryptic footnote in some unpublished Supreme Court of Virginia order. This is black letter law, and owners, I think that this is confusing. I think owners are...
It's misleading, John. Let's call a spade a spade.
Well, yes, it's misleading. It
intentionally.
Well, I can't look into people's hearts, but I know their hearts, John.
I know them.
Well, all I know is what is underlined here, and this is not what the Supreme Court of Virginia has been telling us and holding in all these cases over this year. Is what they've been telling us is that the association is limited by the governing documents and by the way that the courts have this disfavor towards enforcing restrictive covenants. So someone could read this and assume that this is true, and all sorts of crazy things could happen in their HOA, and then one day they finally find themselves and they meet someone who tells them that, oh, did you know that there's the Supreme Court of Virginia has repeatedly held that the board can only do what they're allowed to do under the governing documents, and they may have waived all sorts of rights to assert legal rights, whether in court or in other contexts, that may have been very important to them, to their families, to their property values. And I think that this sentence ought to be removed from this document. That's my opinion.
You know, first of all, like I said earlier, I think at this point it's too late, because buying a house is an emotional purchase. So you go in and you fall in love with the house. None of this is going to make any sense. Nobody is going to read all of this stuff. Put in one sentence, and, you know, they might see it. When I was in real estate, the most effective flyer I ever had contained one word. And people were able to read one word. If I had sent out something like this, nobody would have read it. We don't read that. So you want to make it as succinct and as plain and easy to understand as possible. So you lose all your rights. You know, you could put that in there. That would be the one word. You're now leaving the American zone. Boom. congratulations, you bought a house and you're now leaving the American Zone. Hand it to them and let them go with it.
Well, that's a very dystopian view of the future, which in my practice, what really I find rewarding is working with people who don't see a light at the end of the tunnel for solving these kinds of disputes where what the association is doing is wrong, and what they need fixed is essential and is not something they can just live. It's not like, you know, if someone tells you that you can't put garden gnome next to your mailbox. Yeah, it's annoying and it's stupid and it's ridiculous and it's frivolous, but people can live without garden gnomes next to their mailboxes. But a lot of these things that happen are about things that are much more serious. Like if an HOA says, yeah, we know that you need to do a construction project on your property because you have a disabled family member and you've got to, you know, put in a ramp and you've got to create a new bedroom for this person and you're going to have to expand this, do an addition and all that, and they don't want them to do it because they have rules. If you dig deeply into it, you find that actually they do have rights, and mm-hmm. they do have rights to reasonable accommodation for these sorts of things. And in other situations, people tell, you know, you can't have the garden gnome next to the mailbox, but there's nothing in the governing documents that prohibit it. It's just that they want you to think that there's this rule. And it is... So I know what I'm trying to do in my practice is to work with people who don't see the light at the end of the tunnel when there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and we can work together to get there. And that's, I mean, otherwise we should all just, go and live in big apartment buildings and be renters for the rest of our lives. There's no, you know, it's...
You know, that seems to be the preferable choice right now. A lot of people are saying that. But the thing is, you know, you can't have a garden gnome in your front yard. If you look at the governing documents of probably every single association out there, the board has the right to adopt rules and regulations pertaining to the common areas. Your yard is not a common area. They're going to rely on some vague covenant that says you cannot alter the look of the front of the house without written approval from the board. That's where that garden gnome's going to fall in. But they don't have the right, you know, they don't have the right to come in and make rules. That's one thing. Your private property is still sacrosanct. If there's no covenant against it, you can't possibly have agreed to it.
And the other thing is that the Supreme Court of Virginia has held, I think there are similar rules in other states, that in order for the board to adopt a regulation that is not an amendment, a valid amendment to the covenants, that isn't signed, sealed, and delivered by 75% of all owners and has been done on pink paper or whatever, you know, whatever the statutory and contractual requirements are, if they're trying to enforce the anti-garden gnome rule against a homeowner based on a regulation that they've adopted recently, or, you know, sometime after the declaration gave them the power to do something like this, not only does the declaration have to authorize them to make rules and regulations, it also has to give them the authority to make rules and regulations of this kind. You can't just give them a blanket authority to make all...
Can they take away a property right? Because anything that's on your property is your own property. Well, it's a right, right?
Well, the Supreme Court of Virginia has said that rules and regulations have to be a reasonable exercise of an empowerment to the board in the governing documents, so that, you know, if you have, you know, let's say the covenants say that the board has the authority to adopt rules and regulations regarding architectural conformity in order to ensure the safety and health of the residents, and then let's say you want to put a garden gnome next to your flower pots that has, you know, the Washington Redskins quarterback on it. There's nothing that I don't think that that's a reasonable exercise of that authority under the covenants, because while some people might be offended by your choice in sports fans, it's not impacting anyone's health or safety. It's just, you know, Cowboys fans aren't going to like it. That's not a health issue. So I think it's, these things are complex, and these are things that many lawyers don't understand these things. There are many cases that interpret these things, and even lawyers who are experienced in them have to go back and to check to make sure that they understand how these restrictive covenants are being applied now in light of different statutory changes. These aren't the kinds of things that most people are going to very... It's not reasonable to expect most people to understand how a rule... You know, a rule might be unenforceable. All they know is that they've got a notice of a violation that's come in the mailbox, and then they call the property manager and they say, how can you do this? And they say, well, we have the authority to do it under, you know, such and such, and under the documents or whatever they are. And then they get sued, and then they ask the lawyer for the association. He says, oh, yeah, well, we have the authority to do this. Well, we wouldn't be filing this lawsuit if we didn't have the authority to do it. But these are all people who may be doing their jobs in a certain sense, but they don't have – it's not their job to tell the homeowner what they can do, if anything, to avoid getting this lien or getting this fine or getting – this money judgment for whatever it is. It's they're there for the other side. Unfortunately, real estate has, between mortgage finance and community association issues, owning real estate is just simply no longer a simple thing, and it ought to be. I mean,
I was going to say there's no need for this. There's absolutely no need for this. This has just gone way out of the bounds of decency, I think. And a good thing to do is to ask the association to cite their authority, because frankly, when you do, they'll give you anything, and it has nothing to do with their authority to prevent you from having a garden gnome. You know, they'll say, oh, here it is. And you go, well, that's not what it says.
Right. And I mean, especially online, you sometimes hear the words fiduciary duty being bandied around, and, you know, board members and attorneys like to throw around the phrase fiduciary duty and business judgment rule. But these things don't mean that you are empowered to do whatever you think is in the best interest of the association. It only means that if the governing documents kind of create some kind of discretion for the board to exercise, and the board can exercise that for the best interests of the community. It's not some sort of expansive doctrine. It actually limits the board's authority, and it's completely misused and confuses people. And I usually, when I hear the phrase fiduciary duty or business judgment rule, I kind of perk up, because I'm wondering if someone is trying to pull a fast one on someone.
There seems to be a lot of defensive behavior, I think, by the association. Sometimes they'll go after someone, and if that person won't roll over, they'll get very, very defensive about it. I remember when I was on the board, the manager said, you know, he said, why are you going after A when B is doing the same thing? Oh, well, B will fight me back. And I'm afraid of B. Oh, really? You know, you can't, you just can't do that. It doesn't work. I mean, I don't care what you do, and you can't tweak it and make it work. It's just...
Resale disclosure packet rules and contract provisions they don't work. They need to be reformed. I don't think that's going to make associations... That's going to fix the community association model, but it's something that it would at least create... people would have a chance.
John, thank you so much for coming in. Thank you so much for your insights.
Well, it's been great. It's been great on your show again, Chu. I look forward to the next
one. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.